Well, good evening. Welcome again. Thank you for coming. I would like to have you open your framework books up to the table of contents. I'm not doing justice to this class as far as calling it the framework overview of all these things that I'm teaching Old Testament. I want to show you a little bit about what's coming just to keep you interested. But on the table of contents is on Roman numeral page 7. This framework book, the class that we've got, is actually an overview of several things for Christianity. We're kind of slowed down in the Old Testament. I'm enjoying it. I hope you're enjoying it. But there are some other things coming. If you look on that page, you can see down there, the first thing we talked about starting back in February, we went through apologetics, kind of how we know there's a God, how we know Christianity is legitimate, New Testament authenticity. We then went through hermeneutics, which is the study of how to interpret the Bible correctly. It's a written document. You have to approach it like a written document. You can't just spiritualize everything. You've got to read it for what it says, and we talked about those things. You can review that. We also talked about the history of the English Bible, how we got our English Bible, the process that it went through, the different translations, the people that were killed over translating it into English. Throughout church history, the thing the church has often fought against was the common people understanding and having access to information, because with information comes power and authority, responsibility. And again, they fought that throughout history. It began in the Garden of Eden. You know, did God really say? And it's still, I mean, really it's a battle yet today. History of the English Bible, of course, Old Testament. One thing I will point out as we go through this, we are doing the kings of Israel. We're going to go back and go through the southern kingdom of Judah also. But once we get to the end of the fall of Israel and the fall of Judah, we move into the time of between Jeremiah to Jesus, those silent 400 years. And I've got all the details in this book, year by year almost. I mean, you know, we skip 5-10 years every once in a while. But the details of how it switched from the Babylonian Empire to the Persian Empire to the Roman Empire to the days of the beginning of the New Testament. And people, a lot of times, it's not in the Bible. It affects the Bible. It's prophesied in the Bible. It sets the stage for the New Testament. So we need to understand a little bit about it. But a lot of times it's just information no one knows. So we'll go over that information as we end the Old Testament survey. Then on the next page of the table of contents, life of Christ, we'll go through the Gospels. Mainly just going through almost, you can see the maps in the book, just where Jesus moved and put all the Gospels together, kind of give a chronology of where he's going during his 3.5-year ministry. You know the parables, you know the stories, you know the miracles, but it's nice to get everything in a chronological order, because if he says something at the beginning of his ministry, it may change the way it's understood compared to being said at the end of his ministry. You know what I'm saying? It's who's he talking to, and what's the atmosphere of when he's saying it. The book of Acts, we go through the book of Acts. Basically, that's Paul's travels. Church history is another area. Don't be deceived. There's only 3 chapters there. That's 2,000 years of history. And that is so important to understand church history. Not only to know where we came from and the people that have paid a price to get us where we're at, but you can see the development of doctrine. The scriptures have stayed the same, but now as people begin to interpret it and develop that theology, or issues that we may have even in our churches or in groups today of debating, it's already been talked about. In most cases, it's already been discussed, already been hammered out, ironed out, and you're going to fall on one side or the other. But anyway, church history, of course, besides the people and the events, is very interesting. Then before we do the New Testament, I will flatter myself and tell you that I'm going to teach you something about Greek. I'm a shop teacher. I don't have a Greek degree. I make out letters and things like this. But the point there is there are so many good tools, Bible tools, study tools, interlinear Greek New Testaments, word studies that use the Greek, that if you can somehow understand a little bit of the letters and be able to sound out some words and recognize some words, you have access to these tools. I'm not a Greek scholar. You're not going to become a Greek. You may be. I don't know who you are. Maybe you are a Greek scholar. But just to be able to access these tools, you have a doorway into a whole world that was not available 120 years ago. It had not been discovered. It had not been made available to people just like you and I. You go back 500-600 years, Greek wasn't even studied. I mean, we talked about that in church history, or when we talked about the New Testament. There's a day where they were studying the Bible out of Latin, and that was the best they could do. And so there's a lot to be discovered. But anyway, we'll talk a little bit about Greek. It's kind of interesting to get into certain parts of speech. New Testament, again, we'll go, look, there's only 5 chapters. That should go pretty fast. Only 5 chapters in the New Testament. But we'll hit those books, and you know, just again, we can't stop and go verse by verse, but it'd be, it's And one of the problems that I do have is I teach verse by verse, like I just finished Genesis. Took 76 Sundays to do Genesis. And that started in 2007. So, I mean, we're talking about a three-year span. And so by the time you get through 3 years of teaching and you're into Genesis 50 or 49, it's like, how you've forgotten what we talked about in Genesis. You could go back and teach it again, you know. And so there is something to be said about verse by verse, slow down and get deep. But there's also something to be said to step back and read the book of Romans like it was written, a letter. Here, it's a long letter. I've never written a letter that long. But it's like it all just flows. And so sometimes when you break it down so small, it's good to do that, but it's also good to step back and see the big picture. And so we'll try to do that in the New Testament. And then one of my favorite areas, and yours too, I'm sure, is the area of theology. Sounds bad, sounds boring, but you can start going to the study of God, the study of Scripture, the study of angels. And a lot of these things you already know, but it's so nice to get these things, you know, put together in structural fashion so that you have an organization. And find out where you agree on certain things. And how, you know, even as I go through and I study theology, it's like I may have, you know, go back 20 years or something, I may have these ideas that are out here that they're really not Orthodox Christian ideas. It's like there's evidence that I've got to come in line with Orthodox theology. Of course, there's discussion on that too. But anyway, those are some things that are coming. So just in case you're thinking, wow, Old Testament class, well, that's where we're at right now, and we'll keep proceeding. Go to page 111 in your book, if you don't mind, please. And we'll look at a few things just to kind of set a stage for where we're at. We're probably going to try to cover, again, this is what I'd like to get through tonight, just to stay in that survey mode. But we're going to cover about 40, 50 years of history. If we get all the way through it, the kings that we have listed right here, we talked last week, and we'll review it again this week, the house of Omri, Ahab's house, Omri, Ahab, Ahaziah, and Joram, those are the four kings, you know, with Jezebel being Ahab's wife. Those are the four kings of Omri's dynasty. They come right before this. They reign for about a period of about 44 years. Now, after the last king is the last king, Joram is killed by Jehu. That begins a new dynasty. It's going to be a four-generation dynasty. Elisha is going to make the prophecy, or in the Bible, it's going to have a prophecy that God was pleased with Jehu. He was going to let him have a four-generation dynasty. This will be his son, his grandson, and his great-grandson. This would be his great-great-grandson, or the fifth generation, but notice he's only going to reign for 6 months. He's just going to get on the throne just long enough to be assassinated and begin the final 31 years of the nation of Israel. But we'd like to get through, this is about an 88-year period as we go through here, with the key king being Jeroboam, the second 41-year reign, very prosperous time, and then Jehu, the one that started it. So again, if we go through all these, that'd be 88 years. So we may, if we go through all these chapters, we're going to be covering a period of about 100 years. We'll see. But nonetheless, on this map right here, one of the key places, here's our border. This is the nation of Judah. And that's got all the kings, of course, from Judah, come from the line of David. We've talked about Jehoshaphat. We've talked about Joram. They continue. Joash is coming. It'll have Hezekiah all the way down to the last king, Zedekiah. But that'll all be in the line of David. Up here, the capital up here is Samaria, and this land, of course, is called the land of Israel. Some of the key places tonight that I want you to notice, and we kind of review from last week, over here in the land of Gilead, this is still Israel territory over here. This was given to Ephraim and Manasseh in this area, or Manasseh. This is Ramoth-Gilead. Ramoth-Gilead, it's where the Arameans up here, the northern kingdom right here, they've come down and they've taken Ramoth-Gilead. Again, it's a very important trade route going all the way down to the spice routes. Cuts across here to the Jezreel Valley, right in here, the Jezreel Valley. And on this Jezreel Valley, you're going to have the city of Jezreel that we're going to want to, that's going to be an important city tonight. And again, the city of Samaria. There's going to be travel back and forth across the Jezreel Valley here tonight. So Ramoth-Gilead, there's battles going on over here, fighting the Arameans for this trade route here, or this major city, Jezreel and Samaria. You can see those on your map right there. Another city we will mention here tonight is the city of Dothan, which is just right up in this area here. Dothan, Elisha is going to be there. There's a couple other places that we'll bump into as we go by there. So I don't forget, I want to start this right here. We're going to talk about Jezebel tonight a little bit. Again, we're going to mention her name at least. This is biblical archaeology from March, April of 2008. And what you have right here is a signet ring. It's a seal that you'd use to press into clay or to leave an impression. And every indication, you can look at it real quickly, and you know, I would say it would be a for sure, and they pretty much say the same thing here, but of course you never really know. There could be another person like this. But on this symbol, on this impression, you can see there's royal symbols. There's Egyptian symbols that was influenced, because again, this was influenced by Egypt, or pagan ritual symbols, and the letters that would make out the expression or the word, the Jezebel. And there's one part missing right here that's been chipped, and if that is replaced with the correct Hebrew letter, it would be Jezebel. It's got her name, it's got the pagan symbols on it, and it's got the indication of royalty, and it belongs to a woman, which would indicate this is a very elaborate, very higher class. This is royalty. And to have a woman with a similar name like Jezebel, with a royal signet ring found in this land from the same time. Now, this isn't just from somewhere, you know, thousands of years ago. It's from around 850 B.C. What they have found is Jezebel's signet ring. They've found and excavated Ahab's palaces. They found indications of his ivory throne, different things like this that they've made or have discovered that, you know, indicated. They have found in one of the palaces, I don't remember if it's I think it's Jezreel or Samaria, I don't remember which palace it was, but they have found a makeup kit that belonged to someone in the palace. And we'll read tonight, Jezebel, the last thing she did was get her makeup kit out and put makeup on before she went to her death. But anyway, I'll start this over here. And I got a little bookmark in here. Oh, back here also, this is from yesterday in church on Sunday. It's a little bookmark. We're talking about prayer, and they're laying back there. We had some extra, so I brought those over here too. In the prayer bookmark, they can look at that very quickly. Okay, well, let's bow our heads and pray, and then we're going to get started in 2 Kings chapter 4. Father, we come to you tonight in the name of Jesus. We do thank you so much for your truth. We thank you for your word. We ask that as we look at tonight, we may understand it, that we may find application to our lives, that we may gain a greater appreciation of your word and of the history that you've laid out before us. Again, we thank you for what's been taking place in the past. Look forward to your work in the future. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, chapter 4, we're during the days of Elisha, and we're going to pick up talking about Elisha. Elisha was operating right around in this area. Of course, he was up and down throughout the land, even going down to battle with the king of Edom, the king of Judah, and the king of Israel facing the Ammonites or the Moabites over here. But this was where the school of prophets were at, with Gilgal, Jericho, Bethel. And we pick up here now with a couple of stories about Elisha. Chapter 3 was just the end. Last week we left off with over here the revolt of Moab, with Israel, Judah, and Edom going to war against the Moabites. And looked like they're defeating them, but something strange happened right at the end. And Israel retreated, and Moab did engrave the battle, and it's referenced in the book here, the framework book, on the Moabite stone, the details of the battle indicating they've completely destroyed Israel. But that was the last thing we talked about in chapter 3. Now, beginning in verse 4, chapter 4. This first story is about the widow. There's a widow. Chapter 4 begins with a widow who's very poor. Her husband has died. She's in debt, and she's going to lose her sons. I mean, this is a completely different world in this case right here. She's going to have to sell her sons to the person she owes money to pay the debt. Then we're going to switch to the Shunammite woman in verse 8, and this is on the other end of the social spectrum. She's very wealthy. In fact, she's so wealthy, she's going to add a room onto her house just for Elisha to stop by when he travels by. You know. But anyway, here we go. Chapter 4, verse 1. The wife of a man from the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that he revered the Lord, but now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as his slaves." Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me what you have in your house." Now, one thing we see here and in other places in these miracles is it comes back to the person. What do you have? And then her efforts or her works in this is going to determine the amount of the miracle she's going to get. We're going to end Elisha's life talking to the last son of, or last line of the house of Ahab. And he's going to say, "Strike the ground with the arrows." And we'll see this later on if we hustle. And the king strikes it three times, and Elisha gets mad at him and says, "Why didn't you strike it five or six times? If you would have struck it five or six times, you would have completely destroyed the Arameans. But because you only struck it three times, you only defeat them three times." So again, we see this tension throughout here of God doing miraculous work in individuals' lives, but it comes down to watch how she could blow this right here. She says, "What?" He says, "What can I do for you?" She says, "Your servant has nothing. I have nothing here." Of course, you know, again, that's that's one perspective. Except a little oil. You know, again, you think of Moses and the staff. What do you have? I just have a staff. That's good enough. God can use that. Just a little oil. Elisha said, go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Now notice the work of obedience here. Ask for empty jars. Don't ask for just a few. Then go inside and shut the door behind you and your sons. Pour oil into all the jars, and as each is filled, put it to one side. So in other words, if she goes off and gets four jars, she's going to fill up four jars. But if she goes off and finds a canning company and brings her loads the garage up and she's got boxes of jars, it's like, okay, God can fill those up. So, I mean, you see that tension right there. If she brought three jars, God says, I can fill that up. If she would have backed up truckloads of jars, God says, okay, I can fill that up. Her response, of course, is going to have an impact here. God's doing the work, doing the miracle, but he's responding. Verse 5, she left him and afterwards shut the door behind her and her sons. They brought in the jars to her and she kept pouring. When all the jars were full, she said to her son, bring me another one. But he replied, there's not a jar left. Then the oil stopped flowing. She went and told the man of God, Elisha, and he said, go sell the oil, pay your debts. You and your sons can live on what is left. So again, a miracle, not just paid the debts, but more than she needed and to live on. Next verse, verse 8. One day Elisha went to Shunem, and Shunem is right there by Megiddo, right up in this, by Dothan, right in the same area here of the Jezreel Valley, or Megiddo, Valley of Armageddon. One day Elisha went to Shunem, and a well-to-do woman was there who urged him to stay for a meal. So whenever he came by, he stopped there to eat. She said to her husband, I know that this man who often comes our way is a holy man of God. Let's make a small room on the roof and put in it a bed and a table and a chair and a lamp for him. Then he can stay there whenever he comes to us. And so somewhere, again, Elisha's traveling back and forth. We're going to see him later tonight up here on Mount Carmel again over here by the Mediterranean Sea. So he's traveling quite a bit into here. But he comes by frequently. He's traveling. He's a prophet. He's teaching. He's helping bring revival to the culture. Verse 11. One day when Elisha came, he went up to his room and lay down there. He said to his servant Gehazi. Now he's got a servant. Like Elijah had Elisha as a servant, Elisha has Gehazi. And Gehazi is going to be the one who's going to be the next prophet potentially. there's many prophets. And one of the other prophets whose name is going to pop up here tonight is going to be Jonah, who's going to be mentioned here in 2 Kings. Jonah, the one who the book is written about, is trained in the school of the prophets with Elisha and Gehazi. Well, anyway, Elisha says to Gehazi, call the Shunammite, that's the woman. And he called her, and she stood before him. Elisha said to him, tell her, you have gone to all this trouble for us. Now, what can be done for you? Can we speak on your behalf to the king or the commander of the army? Now, contrary to kind of our impression of prophets, look at the prophet Elisha. He says, I want to do you a favor. Do you want me to tell the king something or the general of the army? Is there anything we can do for you? Now, I don't have friends like this, you know, it's like, or even no prophets or pastors who say, hey, is there something I can do for you? You want me to talk to the president or the Senate for you? It's like, oh, well, you know, I don't know those people. Yeah, don't go to the town hall meetings either, but nonetheless. She replied, she says, I have a home among my own people. Now, it's interesting here, just a note, that when it says king, is there something I can say to the king on your behalf? At this time, there's nothing. She says, I've got a home. I have no need. Eventually, as we get through this book, there's going to come a famine in the land. Elisha's going to tell her, you need to leave the land, otherwise you'll die. So she goes and lives in the land of the Philistines, which isn't that far away. It's like right here. And she survives there, I think it's for 7 years. And after 7 years, she returns to find her property, her home, has been sold. And so she goes to the king at that time to get her property back. So just so you know, it sounds kind of strange. There's something I can say to the king on your behalf. And she says no, but it's almost, in a sense, prophetic because the day is coming when she is going to need the prophet to talk to the king on her behalf. Maybe the prophet has a sense, a word from God that he needs to talk to the king on her behalf, but it's not that time yet. Just an interesting point right there. What can be done for her? Elijah asked Gehazi. Gehazi said, well, she has no son and her husband is old. Then Elisha said, call her. So he told her about a year from now, about a year, you'll have a son in your arms. Of course, she says, no, my Lord, don't mislead me. I don't want to get excited. Don't do that to me. Well, verse 17, but the woman became pregnant, and the next year about that same time, she gave birth to a son just as Elijah had told her. The child grew, and one day he went out to his father who was with the reaper. So they're out there farming. This is the boy. You know, we don't know how old he is. You know, 7, 8, 10 years old, a few years later. He's out. With his father complains of a headache, he says right here, my head, my head. His father told the servant, carry him to his mother. Isn't that just what a father does when a child is not feeling well? go see your mom. I speak on experience right there. I tell them to get a drink or go outside. I don't feel good. Go outside and run around. Yeah, see. I did that one time to Benjamin, and that was about 3:30 in the afternoon. I don't feel good. He came back in. I said, well, have some water. We tried all the tech, everything I knew about medicine, running around, drinking water. About 8 o'clock, he still didn't feel good, so I thought I'd better take him to the hospital, and he had an appendicitis. So Tony was away at a women's retreat at that time. Now, I'll tell you one other thing for the men that are listening here tonight. There's a time when the woman wants you to step up and be a man, and I'm willing to do that role. So I'm thinking, now, how many of you guys, you're going to hear this two ways. I shouldn't be doing this. I should be teaching the Bible. I'm sorry. But your wife's away at a retreat, you know, hotel, swimming pool, guest speakers, all the friends are there, food. It's a Friday night. I was babysitting my kids. Isn't that funny? I'm babysitting my kids. And then someone else had dropped off four more. So I've got like 10 kids I'm taking care of by myself. And then one's getting this appendicitis. But I got the supper going, I got everything going. Kids are all running around their yard drinking water. Everybody's happy. And finally about 8 o'clock, I take Ben to the hospital. And the doctor says, he's got an appendicitis. It took a little while to determine that. We think he got appendicitis. We're going to go in and have surgery. Ben, of course, was smiling. He can't wait to experience it. He was excited. Oh, yeah. He's already going to go to the hospital and not get an operation. And he was excited to get one. He's in junior high. So I said, okay, go ahead. And so, you know, we went ahead and did the thing. And so far the men are thinking, and I don't see what's wrong. Some of the women are going, oh, my gosh, I can't believe you did this. And, you know, Ben came out of surgery about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, okay, well, he's fine again. He's coming around again. He went to sleep. So I went home, checked on the other kids, you know. They had some older kids in high school, so they weren't left alone, you know. And picked them all up. And the next day at about 7:30, we went out and got donuts and saw Ben, and everything's fine. And came back home, you know, about 11 o'clock. So my wife calls, says, how's things going? Pretty good. Everything fine? Yeah, says, Ben had appendicitis, had his appendix out. And there was this cold silence on the other end of the phone. Just no, it's like, and all of a sudden you just, no, I'm being the man. I'm handling the situation. And I'm just, man, I couldn't wait for this phone call to say, made supper, kids are in bed, everybody's safe, Ben's had appendicitis, everything's taken care of, and you love me, right? And it was just silent. I thought, this isn't what I thought would happen. And she says, the next time one of my children has a body part removed, call me. And I was in trouble. And I was and I spent the next 3 hours apologizing. She says, I'm coming home right now. And she dropped out of the meeting, came right home, and the rest of the afternoon was damage control. I did not see it coming. I had no idea. So, thus, the man right here, biblical right here. His father told a servant, carry him to his mother. I had not studied it from that position. Now I understand what he's saying. Ain't going to deal with this. Take him to the mom. After the servant had lifted him up and carried him to the mother, the boy sat on her lap until noon. Then he died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God. Took him up to the room where he was staying and then shut the door. Now she called her husband and says, please send me one of the servants and a donkey so I can go to the man of God quickly and return. Why go to him today? He's got no clue. He says, today's not a new moon. In other words, today's not the Sabbath. We don't go to church today. Why are you going to see the man of God? She just says, it's all right. In other words, she said, it's peace. It's okay. She saddled the donkey and said to her servant, lead on. Don't slow down for me unless I tell you. So she set out and came to the man of God on Mount Carmel. So she's going from this Shunem right in the Jezreel Valley up to, you know, it's not like a long ways, but it's, you know, 15 miles, something like this. When he saw her at a distance, the man of God said to his servant, Gehazi, look, there's the Shunammite. Run to meet her and ask her, are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is your child all right? This looks like an emergency. So she runs to Gehazi runs down to meet her. Elisha seems to be getting older here. He's got a servant doing a lot of the physical work for him. She says, same thing, peace. Everything's all right. When she reached the man of God at the mountain, she took hold of his feet. Gehazi came up to push her away. This doesn't look right. She comes up to the man of God, grabs his feet, touching the prophet. He pushes her away. But the prophet Elisha says, leave her alone. She is in a bitter distress. But the Lord, listen to this. All the things Elisha has done and seen. He saw Elisha taken away. He's going to see Dothan surrounded by chariots of fire. He's going to know when the king's wife is coming to see him. He knows who she is before she gets there, even though she's got a disguise on. Now this woman is grabbing his feet, crying, is in distress. He says, leave her alone. She is in bitter distress. You know, everybody can see that. But the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me why. He said, I have no idea what's going on. Just kind of an interesting angle right there. Did I ask you for a son, my Lord? Didn't I tell you, don't raise my hopes? I told you I didn't want this. Elisha said to Gehazi, you know, it is not because the Spirit of the Lord revealed anything to him. It's like, I think there's something wrong with the son. Tuck your cloak in your belt. Take my staff in your hand and run. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. If anyone greets you, do not answer. Lay my staff on the boy's face. And again, in this culture right here, if you'd meet somebody, you're traveling, you wouldn't just say hi. You'd stop for conversation. And so he says, just get going. You've got to get there. Lay my staff on the boy's face. The child's mother says, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So he got up and followed her. So Gehazi's running ahead of the staff. The woman won't leave until Elisha comes himself. Gehazi, verse 31, went on ahead and laid the staff on the boy's face, but there was no sound or response. So Gehazi went back to meet Elisha and told him, the boy has not awakened. So again, Elisha doesn't know what's going on. The staff doesn't do anything, and everybody's, you know, Gehazi's being obedient. When Elisha reached the house, there was the boy lying dead on his couch. He went in, shut the door on the two of them, and, you know, so the Shunammite woman and Gehazi stay outside, and he prayed to the Lord. Then he got up on the bed and lay upon the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. As he stretched himself out up on him, the boy's body grew warm. Elisha turned away and walked back and forth in the room, probably praying again. I mean, again, you see how this is kind of like, it's like there's details in here, and it's like, what do the details mean? It's not even real clear. It's like, is he praying, interceding? I'm going to think he's praying. He doesn't know what's wrong. This staff didn't work. He's prayed. Nothing happened. But it's similar to Elijah possibly looking over and seeing the cloud of rain coming, meaning he prayed, nothing happened. He prayed seven times till finally it began to happen. Persistence in prayer maybe is being demonstrated here. But Elisha knows what he wants. He continues to pray until the result comes. Elisha turned away and walked back and forth in the room and then got on the bed and stretched out upon them once more. The boy sneezed seven times. Okay, again, why seven times and why is it written here? I mean, again, I'd like to be able to tell you, and again, I think there's a reason. As you study the Bible, sometimes things start coming together. That's why you just keep studying and keep moving forward. I don't know why seven times. Seven is the number of completion. And open his eyes. Elisha summoned Gehazi and says, call the Shunammite. And he did. When she came, he says, take your son. She came in, fell at his feet, bowed to the ground. Then she took her son and went out. And there's your story. Okay, next story. Verse 38. Now, again, if this was church or something, I'd stop and try and make application out of that. It's like, whatever. But anyway, we're moving on. Survey. Verse 38. Elisha returned to Gilgal. Okay, he was up here at Mount Carmel, came down to Shunem. Now he's down here in Gilgal, down in this area. This is the school of the prophets. And once again, he's at the house with all the prophets. He returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine, which, again, is probably a sign of God's not pleased with how the nation's going in that region. While the company of the prophets was meeting with him, he said to his servants, put on the large pot and cook some stew for these men. Okay, so let's make dinner. One of them went out into the fields to gather herbs and found a wild vine. He gathered some of its gourds and filled his fold of his cloak. When he returned, he cut them up and put them in the pot of stew, though no one knew exactly what they were. What are those? I don't know. They look good. Cut them up and put them in the pot. Yep. The stew was poured out for the men, but when they began to eat, they cried out, O man of God, there is death in the pot. So apparently the gourds were some kind of poison, and they could not eat it. Elisha said, get some flour. He put it into the pot and said, serve it to the people to eat, and there was nothing harmful in the pot. Again, nothing else. It shows, again, Elisha's ability as a prophet, shows God's working with him, shows God's taking care of his prophets in a time of famine. And again, why are they picking these gourds? They don't even know what they are. Famine. They're just glad to find something green. It's, you know what I'm saying? It's like, why would they do this? The land is in a famine. They find something. It's poison. They try to cook with it. They realize it's poison. Elisha fixes. God's got us covered. Next, a man of God, verse 42, a man of God from Baal Shalisha, which is just real close to Gilgal, right in the same circle here. It's not a very popular city, but right there in the area. A man from Baal Shalisha bringing the man of God 20 loaves of barley bread. Now, this is interesting. 20 loaves of bread. This is something you'd do for the priest. You'd bring, especially when it says, bake from the first ripe grain along with some heads of the new grain. This is the first fruits offering. It's supposed to be going to the priest. But, of course, there's no priest up here. The priests would be down here in Jerusalem that are serving the temple. Up here, they're all Baal prophets and Baal priests and golden calf priests. And so, interesting, they're bringing it to Elisha, okay? Give it to the people to eat, Elisha said. How can I set this before 100 men? Again, remember, there's a famine in the land. He scrounged out 20 loaves of bread from the first parts of his crop, brings it to Elisha. Elisha says, feed the people. He says, I can't give him 20 loaves of bread for 100 people. But Elisha answered, give it to the people to eat, for this is what the Lord says. They will eat and have some left over. Then he set it before them, and they ate, and some was left over according to the word of the Lord. Again, what you see right here, another thing, is you do see a tendency right here similar to Jesus' ministry. Elisha is very similar to Jesus' ministry in many ways. We move on, verse 5. Jesus refers to this one, this miracle in one of his messages. Now Naaman was a commander of the army of the king of Aram. So let's get this up here quick. Again, the Arameans. Again, next week we'll be talking about the kingdom that comes down from the north, further north, the Assyrians. That's where Nineveh's at. They're going to come down and attack the Arameans. But right now we're still in this time, kind of a void in world history empires. This is just the country of Aram. This is the country of Israel. And this is, we'll just say somewhere in here, is Samaria. And up here is the king of Aram. They're continually invading back and forth, fighting with each other. This is how Ahab died. He died over here in Ramoth-Gilead. There's invasions coming here all the time. And the king, Naaman, was the commander of the army. So, in a sense, you could call him General Naaman under King Ben-Hadad. He was the great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now, what's interesting about this is we've left the land of Israel, the land of pagan worship, you know, Baal, golden calves, and we've gone to a pagan country, a Gentile country, the Arameans. We're talking about the king, and we're talking about their general Naaman. And what's going to end up happening, as you know, this general, a Gentile, is going to come down to the prophet, actually come to the king first. King's not going to know what to do. Find the prophet of Israel and be healed by the prophet of Israel, the Gentile. Jesus is going to refer to that. He says, were there no lepers? Were there no lepers in Israel at this time? It's like, well, surely there was. So why did we heal someone from Aram? Because this man was looking for help. This man was looking for an answer. Down here, no one's looking. Everybody's happy. They're fine. They may have leprosy, but they're not asking. And that was Jesus' point. He said, we could have healed somebody in Israel, but no one was interested. Verse 2, it's kind of an interesting idea. Now, bands from Aram, invading groups, had gone out and taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, if only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy. Man, I wish you guys were in Israel because there's a man, Elisha, in Samaria. He could fix this. So, of course, the woman tells Naaman. Verse 4, Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. By all means, go, the king of Aram replied. I will send a letter to the king of Israel. Now, Joram, this is still in the line of Ahab. This would be Ahab's second son. Understand, they have very little regard for Elisha. Yet the king Ben-Hadad from the Gentile country coming down sending letters to appeal to talk, find this prophet. And he, very important for the story, so Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, that's 750 pounds of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, 150 pounds of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, with this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy. Verse 7, as soon as the king of Israel, Joram, read the letter, he tore his robes and said, am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me? He's trying to mock me. Sending me his general, one of his top generals, with leprosy, saying, fix this. Well, Elisha hears about this, that the king Joram had torn his clothes, and he sent a message to the king. Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. So Naaman went with his horses and chariots. Again, this is the general of the Arameans. This is one of the, he's got chariots. He's going to have probably a battalion of soldiers coming with him. He's in enemy territory. He's looking for a doctor in enemy territory. It goes on, verse 9. So Naaman went with his horses and chariots, stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger, Gehazi, to say to him, go, wash yourself seven times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed. So the Jordan River is over here, you know, I don't know, again, maybe about 15 miles or so. And he says, go over here and wash in the Jordan River. Now, again, the Jordan River is nothing, you know, it's special because of biblical, you know, conversation, but it's just a river. Sometimes it's not very wide. You know, when it's dry, it's not very wide. Sometimes it's wider depending on the season and stuff. But it's just a local river there. And Naaman is completely put off by this. Being to go to the Jordan River, wash yourself seven times, verse 11, and Naaman replies in a similar fashion, especially coming from a pagan culture of where if you're going to talk to a god or something, you're going to have to do something to prove you're worthy. But Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of his Lord, his God, wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Kind of like, you know, you ever see the, you know, the meetings on television or something. Something that we can see. Some kind of flashy, you know. Are not, in any mentions, are not Abana and Parpa, those are rivers of the Arameans, up by Damascus, which is one of the capital cities up here in Aram, better than any of the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So he turned and went off in rage. He said, I'm not going to do that. He said, if that's all it takes, if it's the water, I got water up here. Naaman's servant went to him and said, my father, if the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much, you know, climb the highest mountain, swim the deepest sea, something like this. You know, he brought along 150 pounds of gold. I mean, well, I can heal you, but it's going to be 150 pounds of gold. I got that. Just go, but go, just dip in the water. It's like, how's that impressive? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed? He says, if you would have done something great, why not just go jump in the river? Because he thinks he's making a fool of me, because everybody's going to stand around and watch me jump in the water. In other words, all they're doing is mocking the general of the Arameans. So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan seven times, as the man of God had told him. And his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all of his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and says, now I know that there is not a God in all the world except of in Israel. Please accept my gift. The prophet answered, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, before whom I stand, I will not accept anything, even though Naaman urged him. He refused. Don't need anything. If you will not, said Naaman, please let me, your servant, be given a part of the earth. And he asked for some dirt from Israel. He says, because I basically what he's doing, he's converting. He's, I'm going to now follow Yahweh. But he says, the king, Ben-Hadad, always has me worship his God. He leans on my arm. And that doesn't mean he's hurt or needs assistance. That means during his ceremonies, he always has Naaman standing right beside him. And so during any of the official worship services, he says, I've got to be there with my king, but I want some dirt from Israel so I can go to this dirt and worship the God of Israel. Again, that was his understanding. Elijah says, yeah, go take some dirt, go in peace. Then, of course, you know the story right here. Gehazi then, of course, having been tempted by the 175 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold, the 10 clothes, sets of clothes, and thinking Elisha, and again, they've got, for example, the school of the prophets. You know, they're trying to find stew. They've got widows down there trying to sell oil to save their boys from slavery. And now here's this great opportunity. Elijah says, don't want to go there. That's not going to work. We're trusting God. This will be just a distraction for the people. Well, anyway, it was a distraction for Gehazi. He runs after, makes up a story, says, hey, two guys just showed up, two freshmen just came in to join the School of the Prophets. We need something for them. He says, we have some clothes. He says, sure, and can we have this, some talent of silver? Sure, take two. And so he ends up saying, and he comes back with it, hides it somewhere. When he walks in on Elisha, Elisha says, where have you been, Gehazi? Oh, your servant didn't go anywhere. I'm in verse 26 now. But Elisha said to him, was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you, Naaman? Is this the time to take money or accept clothes or olive groves, vineyards, flocks, herds, men servants or maid servants? Naaman's leprosy will cling to you and to your descendants forever. Then Gehazi went away from Elisha's presence, and he saw he was leprous and as white as snow. Next story, verse 6, chapter 6. The company of the prophet said to Elisha, look, the place where we meet with you is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan where each of us can get a pole and let us build a place for us to live. So in other words, the school of prophets is growing. Now we're back down here to Gilgal area, Bethel, Jordan. They said, we're going to go down the Jordan River, down to the thickets of the Jordan. We're all going to cut down a tree, bring back a trunk or a pole, and we're going to build something. Elisha says, go. That's a good idea. Verse 3. Then one of them says, won't you please come with your servants? I will. So Elisha's going to go down there. Probably older, you know, and has a hard time getting down there. But again, they're doing all the work. He's going to go down and watch. They went to the Jordan and began to cut down trees. As one of them was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. You know, swinging like a hammerhead or something, flies, splash in the water. Maybe the whole thing fell in. Oh, my Lord, he cried out, it was borrowed. The man of God asked, where did it fall? Then he showed him the place. Elijah cut a stick, threw it there, and made the iron float. Lift it out, he said. Then the man reached out his hand and took it. End of story. Verse 8. Now, the king of Aram, Ben-Hadad II, was at war with Israel. Now, we're back up here. There's war right here with these guys. After conferring with his officials, Ben-Hadad had said, I will set up my camp in such and such a place. So it's a top secret meeting. The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware of passing that place because the Arameans are going down there. So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elijah warned the king so that he was on his guard in such places. So Joram, the king, you know, Ahab's second son, is still the king of Israel. And God is still showing his mercy to Israel by warning the king of Israel, because these are still his people, trying to draw the people back to him. He's going to send a famine here in a little bit. And so the king, Joram, knows that, you know, he's got inside advice directly from God. Verse 11, this enraged the king of Aram. He summoned his officials and demanded of them, will you not tell me which of us is on the side of the king of Israel? You know, Haisa, who would be the most suspect person, would you think? Naaman. Naaman, did you make some kind of agreement down there with those guys? And they said, no. It says, none of us, my lord, the king said of one of the officers, maybe Naaman said that. But Elisha the prophet, who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom. How do you know that? Well, I met the guy. God shows him stuff. So now they know the problem's Elisha. At least that's their theory. Go find out where he is, the king ordered, so I can send men and capture him. The report came back. He is in Dothan. So it takes a couple days. They journey down. They find out right here in Dothan. That's right around there where we're, again, the Jezreel Valley. We're going to erase Israel, and that's Samaria. Samaria is more over here. You can actually, if you want to see the actual place, you can look on your map right there. So they're going to come down with their chariots. They're going to surround the city of Dothan because that's where Elijah is at. Okay, so where are we at here? I lost my place. Fort, okay. Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there. They went by night and surrounded the city. Verse 15, when the servant Gehazi of the man of God got up and went out early in the next morning. Now again, you'd say, well, I thought Gehazi had leprosy, and this may be a different person. The problem is Gehazi's name's going to pop up again later here. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I thought he was, you know, at one time I thought, well, he's got leprosy, he's done. But, and it doesn't say Gehazi here, but it does, his name does pop up somewhere else. I'm not sure where. But anyway, when the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh, my Lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. So again, there's, the Arameans are surrounding the city. Well, Elisha says, don't be afraid. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. You've heard this before. Now, again, it's probably not, Elisha is not seeing the angelic army. He's already seen it, for example, when Elijah's gone up to heaven or whatever. He knows that God is protecting Israel. And he prays, and Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes so he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around them. So there's another chariots of fire around the Arameans. As the enemy came towards them, Elisha prayed to the Lord, strike these people with blindness. They're moving in to arrest Elisha. He says, strike them with blindness. So he struck them with blindness as Elisha had asked. Elisha told them, this is not the road, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will lead you to the man you are looking for. And he led them into Samaria. So he leads them a few miles south into Samaria, where the king Joram is at, in the capital city. After they entered the city, Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men so they can see. Now, wouldn't that be surprising? They come down to attack Dothan. They open their eyes up. They're inside the city of Samaria, the very place they wouldn't want to be. The Lord opens their eyes, and they can see. They're in Samaria. Verse 21, when the king of Israel, Joram, saw them, he asked Elisha, shall I kill them, my father? Shall I kill them? Notice he's taking directions from the prophet. No, do not kill them. Would you kill men who've been captured with your own sword or bow? Would you kill prisoners of war just to kill them? No, he says, instead, give them a feast and feed them. So they all fed them, and then, of course, they were sent back home protected and fed, and it says that stopped the raiding bands for a while of Ben-Hadad coming down. But now, Samaria, again, is going to come under the judgment of God. And one of the things God has warned in the law of Moses is he'll send famines. Thus, here we go. And the famine is going to come in different forms. It come in the heavens drying up or not raining. In this case, it's sometime later. It begins by saying sometime later because the last part ended with him saying they didn't invade anymore. Ben-Hadad comes down and surrounds or besieges Samaria. And this is the way they would fight in those times. They'd come down with their army and they would just surround a city. And they couldn't get in because of the walls. The walls were there for protection. But they just surround the city for months and not let any food come in or out. And you can just eat whatever you got, and we'll just wait. And it gets to a place where they're eating everything. It becomes disgusting what they eat. This is with Aram. This is what happens in this time. There's going to be deliverance from this siege right here. But a few years later, by the time we get through of Israel, the Assyrians are going to come down and spend 2 to 3 years in a siege, and that is how Samaria is going to fall. The same thing is going to take place here in Jerusalem. In 586, with 588 to 586, with Jerusalem falling at the hands of the Babylonians, it's going to be a siege, and just wait and starve the people out, slowly beating on their walls. So it would take 2 years to starve out a city. And so nonetheless, here they are. They're under siege. Verse 24 of chapter 6. Sometime later, Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, mobilized his entire army and marched up and laid siege to Samaria. There was a great famine in the city. The siege lasted so long that a donkey's head sold for 80 shekels, that's 2 pounds of silver. Again, a donkey's head, meaning it's not a lot of good eating right there, but it's something. And a quarter of cab of seed pods for 5 shekels. A cab is 2 quarts, and seed pods is dove dung. Their only hope of getting new food in is when birds fly over. It's like, what are you doing today? We're waiting for birds. Here's one. And it's like, hey, we got about 2 quarts. You want to buy it? Yeah, that's supper. Okay, this is called judgment. And when people talk about, someday, America coming under judgment, it's kind of like, what I'm saying? It's not going to be like, man, gas is awful high. And we're paying $4 a gallon. Man, God's judging our nation. It's not going to be like that. It's going to be like, well, birds flying over. As the king of Israel was passing by a wall, a woman cried to him. Now this is what happened in Jerusalem in 70 AD, recorded by Josephus. This very thing right here. And it's warned by God in the book of Leviticus. He will make this happen. This is listed in the judgments of God on a nation. This is not just God warned this would happen, and it happened here. It happened in 70 AD. The king of Israel is passing by on the wall. This is Joram, Ahab's second son. Thank you, Dad. This is about the time Joram is going to think, thanks, Dad. I wish we would have followed God instead of Baal. As the king of Israel is passing by on the wall, the woman cried out, help me, my lord, the king. The king replied, if the Lord does not help you, where can I get help for you? From the threshing floor? From the wine press? Then he asked her, what's the matter? I mean, what am I going to do? She answered, this woman said to me, give up your son so we may eat him today, and tomorrow we'll eat my son. So we cooked my son and ate him. The next day I said to her, okay, it's time to eat your son. But she'd hidden him because she's full. Verse 30, when the king heard the woman's words, he tore his robes. He could not believe his country has come to this level. As he went along the wall, the people looked, and there underneath he had sackcloth on his body. Again, remember how his father Ahab had repented at one time and was wearing sackcloth under his royal garments, and the Lord spoke to Elijah and says, hey, look, the man's humbled himself. I'm gonna hold this judgment off until the next generation because of what he's done. Now Joram is doing the same thing. He's walking along the wall, and they can see up underneath his royal garments, he's got sackcloth on. The king is mourning like the prophets. He's dressing like Elijah privately. He said, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, though now he's ticked, be it ever so severely, if the head of Elisha, son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today. In other words, I know what's wrong. It's Elisha. Just like Ahab blamed Elijah, now Joram's blaming Elisha. Just because the prophet's words came true doesn't mean the prophet's causing this. But they can't get past that. Okay. Verse 32. Now Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. Did you understand how powerful of a statement that is? It doesn't say Elisha was sitting in his house and the prophets were sitting with him. The elders. Whose elders? King Joram's elders. His advisors are over sitting in Elisha's house waiting. What are we going to do? The king sent a messenger ahead, but before he arrived, Elisha said to the elders, "Don't you see how this murderer is sending someone to cut off my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door and hold it shut against him. Is not the sound of his master's footsteps behind him?" Meaning, as soon as he gets here, Joram's right behind him. While he was still talking to them, the messenger came down to him, and the king says, "This disaster is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer?" In other words, it's God doing this. I'm not going to wait for God any longer. I'm going to kill you. Elisha said, "Hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says. About this time tomorrow, a sea or 7 quarts of flour will sell for a shekel." That's 2/5 of an ounce of silver. "And 2 seahs, 13 quarts of barley, for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." So you understand, compare that to what bird dung is selling for now, is wheat and barley, and then the flour is selling for a lot cheaper the next day. "The officer who was armed, the king was leaning," again, one of the officers, the assistant, one of his generals, "said to the man of God, 'Look, even if the Lord should open the floodgates of heaven, could this happen?'" He said, "There's no way. Even if God would intervene, there's no way he can turn this situation around to that ridiculous of a price. The economy cannot turn around that fast." That's not what the king said. That's what the general or the officer that Joram was with. Elisha says, "You will see it with your own eyes, but you will not eat any of it." Now, back to the story from a different angle now. "Now, there were 4 men with leprosy at the entrance of the city gate." I mean, life is really bad for them. I mean, even if they do have some kind of food, it's like, we still got leprosy. So they're outsiders. They're going to die in the city. So they said to each other, "Why stay here until we die? If we say, 'We'll go into the city,' the famine is there. We will die. And if we stay here, we will die. So let's go to the camp of the Arameans and surrender. If they spare us, we live. Maybe they'll make us slaves or something. If they kill us, then we die." So it's dying there in the city, dying here by the gate, or maybe being delivered out there, but we might die there too. So it's 0%, 0%, 50-50. "At dusk, they got up and went to the camp of the Arameans. When they reached the edge of the camp, not a man was there. For the Lord had caused the Arameans to hear the sound of chariots and horses and a great army." Probably the chariot of fire. And they don't think that it's a chariot of fire or the army, angelic army. They think it's the Egyptians or somebody. And in fact, that's what it says. "Look, the king of Israel has hired the Hittite and the Egyptian kings to attack us." Now again, just I cannot stop to say the word Hittite without mentioning history. And liberals have attacked the Bible up until the late 1800s because there's no such thing as the Hittites. There's no Hittite people. And then around 1880, late 1800s, they discovered the entire Hittite empire. In fact, if you look it up on Google now, you can find Hittites. They'll show you the empire that they controlled in the Middle East during one time. Unknown until archaeology discovered it, but recorded in the Bible and was criticized for years by liberals because, well, the Bible is not true. It's more true than some history books. But nonetheless, "So they got up and fled in the dusk and abandoned their tents and their horses and donkeys. They left the camp as it was and ran for their lives. The men who had leprosy reached the edge of the camp and entered one of the tents. They ate and drank and carried away silver and gold and clothes and went off and hid them." They're plundering. These 4 men are plundering the Aramean camp. "They returned and entered another tent and took some other things and hid them also." This is great. "Then they said to each other, 'We're not doing right. This is a day of good news, and we are keeping it to ourselves.'" There's people probably dying at the moment in the city of Samaria from starvation, and they're hoarding silver and, you know, VCRs and stuff in some kind of hideout. "If we wait until daylight, punishment will overtake us." In other words, they've got a conscience. "Let's go at once and report this to the royal palace." So they went and called out to the city gatekeepers and told them, We went into the Aramean camp, and not a man was there, not a sound of anyone, only tethered horses and donkeys and tents left just as they were. The gatekeeper shouted news, and it was reported within the palace. Well, the king is suspicious, of course. You know, you should be. He got up on that night and said to his officers, I will tell you what the Arameans have done to us. They know we are starving, so they have left the camp to hide in the countryside, thinking they'll surely come out, and then we'll take them alive and get the city. In other words, they thought, instead of waiting for them, we'll, you know, the Trojan horse in reverse. We're going to put it outside, they'll open the gates and come out, and we'll rush in and get in the city. We don't have to wait for the starvation. One of his officers answered, have some men take five of the horses that are left in the city, meaning we don't have any horses left, we've been eating them. Their plight will be like that of all of Israelites if they're left here, yes, and they will only be like the Israelites who are doomed, so let us send them to find out what happened. In other words, we got some men that are willing to either going to die in the city or they're willing to die in this adventure. So they selected two chariots with their horses. The king sent them, go and find out what has happened. They followed them as far as the Jordan. In other words, they followed the Arameans all the way to the Jordan, and finding stuff strewn, it was clear that they just left their stuff just running like they're under attack, leaving clothing and equipment. Verse 16, then the people went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. So a seah of flour sold for a shekel, two seahs of barley sold for a shekel. I mean, no one's even buying it. Hey, I got some food for sale. I don't need it. You can't even sell it. It's like you're hoarding all this food. Who are you going to sell it to? Everybody's got food now. In other words, the bottom just fell out. Verse 17, now the king had put the officer on whose arm he leaned in charge of the gate, and the people put him in charge of the gate. He said, okay, you open the gate up. So when he opened the gate up, he saw the deliverance, but the people trampled him on the way out, and it happened just like Elisha had said. Chapter 8 now. It says right here, we'll do chapter 8. Where are we going here? Where we got? How much further we got? Yeah, this will work out pretty good. Not as far as I wanted to get. But chapter 8. Now Elisha had said to the woman whose son he had restored to life, the Shunammite woman, go away with your family and stay for a while wherever you can, because the Lord has decreed a famine in the land that will last 7 years. Kind of maybe playing back into this invasion right here. That might have been why the Arameans came down. But anyway, she's going to run down to the land of the Philistines down here, or bring her family down there. The woman proceeded to do as the man of God said. She was obedient. She and her family went away and stayed in the land of the Philistines 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, she came back from the land of the Philistines and went to the king to beg for her house and land. The king was talking to, there it is, Gehazi. Well, it was 7 or 8 years ago he got leprosy, or you know, maybe 9, 10 years ago. So something's happened here. Gehazi's still in activity here, and it's in the right chronological order, just interesting. The king was talking to Gehazi, the servant of the man of God. So Joram is talking to Gehazi in his palace about Elisha, and he said, tell me about the great things Elisha has done. Just as Gehazi was telling the king how Elisha had restored the dead to life, the woman whose son Elisha had brought back to life came to beg the king for her house and land. Gehazi said, this is the woman, my lord the king, and this is her son whom Elisha restored to life. So now if he was like, say, 7 years old when he had the problem, now he's probably, you know, high teens, you know, maybe in his 20s. The king asked the woman about it, and she told him. Yes, that's exactly what happened. Then he assigned an official to her case and said to him, give back everything that belonged to her, including all the incomes from her land from the day she left the country until now. So there is again, remember how Elisha says, you want me to talk to the king for you? Well, here it is. He did talk to the king for her by giving her son, raising him from the dead. That was the story that got the king's attention, that got her land back. So it all ties together. All seems coincidental, but here it all maybe ties all together. Now, talking now about Aram. We've talked about the king Ben-Hadad the first, Ben-Hadad the second, and now, that's who's still king there, there's going to be a guy named Hazael. Now, going way back to chapter 17, 18, 19 of 1 Kings with Elijah, when Elijah has that big pity party, runs down to Mount Sinai and says, I'm the only one left, and no one's like me. And God says, okay, and you know, fires him, basically says, go anoint. Says, I want you to anoint a prophet, Elisha, anoint a king of Israel, anoint a man by the name of Jehu, who was still just a very young soldier at that time, and anoint for Arameans, Hazael as a king. So Elijah's down here, And God, controlling history, says, I need a new prophet for you, Elijah. I need a new king, Jehu, for Israel. And I need Hazael to be the new king of the Arameans. Now, that was back in chapter 18, 19 of 1 Kings. All this time, we've gone through about 40 years of history or 30 years of history. So here we go. Elijah never anointed Jehu. He never anointed Hazael. He only anointed Elisha, who was going to then finish Elijah's ministry because Elijah got discouraged. Elijah went to Damascus, and Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, was ill. So now where's Elisha? Elijah's up here. If you look at a map somewhere, Damascus is the capital of the Arameans. It's way up north up in here. So Elijah's, you know, he's gone down to Moab. He's gone all to Mount Carmel. He's been up now up in Damascus. And he's up to see Ben-Hadad visiting the king of the Arameans. He's outside, just like Jesus, outside of Israel territory when Jesus went to Caesarea Philippi. When the king was told the man of God has come all the way up here, he said to Hazael, who was one of his generals, one of his main men, take a gift with you and go meet the man of God. Consult the Lord, that's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, which means in the Hebrew, that's the word Yahweh. Consult Yahweh through him and ask him, will I recover from this illness? Hazael went to meet Elisha, taking with him a gift of 40 camel loads of all the finest wares of Damascus, which would be the finest of Damascus there. The reason that's a major city is on these trade routes. So it's the best of the best that the king has. He went and stood before him and says, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, has sent me to ask, will I recover from this illness? Now, if you remember, back in the days of Ahab and Ahab's son Ahaziah, the kings of Israel were sending people to the Philistines to ask the god of Ekron if they were going to recover from an illness. And Elisha called out fire and consumed them and stuff. Now we've got Gentile kings asking Elisha for advice. Well, Elisha answered, go and say to him, you will certainly recover. But the Lord has revealed to me that he will in fact die. He stared at him, Elisha stared at Hazael with a fixed glaze until Hazael felt ashamed. Then the man of God began to weep. Kind of a strange situation right here. Hazael asks, my king asks if I will recover. Elisha looks at him and says, go and say to him, you will certainly recover, but the Lord has revealed that he will certainly die. And just kept staring at Hazael. And Hazael, you know, begins to feel real uncomfortable. You know, you've got a prophet, prophet Elisha, who's intimidating just himself, and then all of this, he's just staring him down, and he began to feel uncomfortable. Then the prophet, during his stare, breaks down and starts to cry. And of course, Hazael says, why is my Lord weeping? Then Elisha says, because I know the harm you will do to the Israelites. I know what's going to happen. I know that they're declining as a society, and I know God is going to use you to bring judgment. Similar to what Jonah is going to say to the Ninevites. That's why Jonah doesn't want to go to Nineveh, because he realizes what's going to happen to Israel if Nineveh recovers. He says, you will set fire to their fortified places, kill their young men with the sword, dash their little children to the ground, and rip open the pregnant women. And he's saying the whole time, staring at him, weeping. Hazael said, how could your servant, a mere dog, accomplish such a feat? In other words, well, I'm interested in it. How would I do that? Just a note, we haven't got to the Assyrians yet. But the Assyrians' king, Salmaneser III, he's going to invade Damascus. He's going to invade Hazael. It is recorded in the Assyrian writings about Hazael. And Hazael is recorded as the son of nobody. Ben-Hadad is the son of Ben-Hadad the first, and then he was a son of, it's a royal line. But Hazael, even in the Assyrian document, calls him Hazael, the son of nobody. He's not even the right king. And that was, again, coming out of the Assyrians, Shalmaneser. Another thing about Shalmaneser, we've talked about Jehu being anointed. We've got to get to him next week. There is, and this is pretty cool, it's in your books. Let me show you real quickly. The framework book. This is, I'm jumping ahead, but look on page 123. I'm talking about Shalmaneser, the king of the of Assyria, that'd be Nineveh, people Jonah's going to prophesy to, coming down and attacking Ben-Hadad in Damascus, the king of the Arameans. But Jehu, when all is said and done, and Assyrian is clearly gaining power, Jehu, along with several other kings, are listed in Assyrian documents as coming up and paying tribute to Shalmaneser, bringing them gifts, saying, we want to appease you. And it's written on the obelisk. Right here, you can see a little, an obelisk would be a four-sided figure, you know, with, it's a black obelisk with inscriptions and details. And here's a picture. If you look at that picture on page 123, you can see Shalmaneser is the third person from the left. And on the face right there, we don't know it because we recognize him, but because of the inscription, that is the king of Israel, Jehu, according to the obelisk. On his face, this is this king right here, paying the king Shalmaneser tribute after he'd brought so much trouble here on the Arameans. Well, we'll get to that later. But nonetheless, let's go back and finish this chapter up. Haziel, the son of nobody, according to the Shalmaneser on that obelisk, says himself, after Elisha says, this is what you're going to do to Israel, Haziel says, how could your servant, a mere dog, accomplish that? He goes, I'm just a servant. I'm just a military man serving the king. How would I ever accomplish that? Then he says right here, the Lord has shown me that you'll become king of Aram. And again, that was what God told Elijah down here on Mount Sinai in 1 Kings. And now we've come all the way up here. Now finally, one of the last things Elijah does is go all the way up here and tell and anoint him, in a sense. How will I do that? You're going to be king. Well, then here's what happens. Remember the prophecy? Ben-Hadad's going to recover, but in fact, he's surely going to die. So he's on his road to recovery. Verse 14, then Haziel left Elisha and returned to his master when Ben-Hadad asked, what did Elisha say to you? Haziel replied, he told me that you would certainly recover. But the next day, he took a thick cloth, soaked it in water, spread it over the king's face so that he died. Then Haziel succeeded him as king. And again, I find it interesting and amazing that we go to 1 Kings, that weird story about Elijah and all those strange things. God says, this is who I'm going to have be king of the Arameans. And now we find out it's being fulfilled by Elisha, the one who replaced Elijah. But not only that, Shalmaneser records it and talks about him, identifies him the same way. We've got the Bible again just comes right together with history. Well, the rest of this chapter 8, Joram is king of Judah. That would be Jehoshaphat's son. Joram is going to marry Ahab and Jezebel's daughter, Athaliah. He's going to reign for, what does it say there, 8 years. And then his son, his and Athaliah's son, this would be Ahab's grandson, Ahaziah, is going to be the king of Judah for only 1 year. He's going to die at the hand of Jehu himself. And that's setting up the stage now for Athaliah to become king of Judah, or the queen of Judah. So again, Jezebel's daughter becomes the queen of Judah down here, just showing you how, you know, bad that is. And chapter 9 is a good place to end because now we're right where I wanted to start tonight. Jehu. The prophet Elijah summoned a man from the company of the prophets and said, tuck in your cloak, go to Ramoth-Gilead over here, and there's a general over there named Jehu, and Elisha sends, going to finish up his ministry, sends a prophet over here to anoint Jehu to be the new king. And that prophet, according to, it fits the time frame perfectly. It fit, because we're going to see his name come up here in the next couple chapters. It fits his role. The Jewish teachers, they teach that it was Jonah, the man that's going to go over here and run for Elijah. Elisha's new servant is Jonah, who's going to then anoint Jehu. And then we've got, we'll try and get through the family of Jehu. Man, we spent 3 weeks on the family of Omri, you know, Omri, Ahab, Ahaziah, and now Joram. And next week, we're going to start talking about the family of Jehu, one of the second dynasty of long dynasties of Israel's kings. And then after that, we've got probably one more week in Israel where we're going to just have the last 31 years of decline. And I really think we can do that in 2 weeks. Keep your heads up. We're just going through the Old Testament. We got other things coming here as we proceed through this. I'm going to pray real quickly, and then Bill Mitchell wants to talk to you just real quickly, say a few things. I don't want to say too much about what he's going to say, but kind of just, you know, thank you for coming to Bible study and keep bringing people. Like, where are we going to put them? But anyway, let's bow our heads and pray. Father, we do thank you so much for your truth. We thank you for your word, and we do ask that we may hear and understand these things. We especially ask that we can apply them to our lives. We pray also for our country. We pray for the churches, and we ask that we may see revival in our land, in our day, that we may be part of it. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Hey, thank you very much. Bill, come on up, please. Give Bill just a few minutes, if you would.